Thank you for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, welcome to the program. We are live Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I want to thank TECN, the Exceptional Conservative Network, for carrying the program live, particularly Ken McClanton, the owner and director of the TECN TV network. He's also a host of his own excellent program. I would urge people to go to their website at TECN/TV and acquaint yourself with all of their excellent programming. They're doing great work. They're out of Washington, D.C. They've got a diverse lineup of guests and of hosts. And of course, this program is live, and as such, we accept phone calls. You can call this program by dialing 617-396-4958. That number again is 617-396-4958. And you can chat with me at this program by going to rumble.com/Moskowitz, and I will read your chat over the air. Today, I'm doing an open line segment. I'm still in the process of testing things out at TECN, so I didn't really line up any guests today. Tomorrow, I have a guest who's hosting an event that is reshaping and redefining the narrative with regard to Israel and the state of Israel and its portrayal and anti-Israel views that emanate both from the left and from the right, frankly. Wednesday, Christina Bob, who is President Trump's personal attorney, will be here. She's got a new book out about the Great Steal of 2020. That's a story that I've been following from the moment it happened right up till today. And I am very pleased that she's putting this into print in a way that is accessible and that really calls out all of those who have used the communistic term election denier to describe anybody that questions the outcome of the 2020 election. And to just say, just to touch on that, I don't think anyone's denying that Joe Biden is the president of the United States. He is. He was sworn in. He was inaugurated. He is the president. Kamala Harris is the vice president. That's how our system works. What we're questioning is how they got there. That's all. And that's something that, of course, is completely consistent with all of the best aspects of American tradition. And in fact, I would argue it's our duty as Americans to always question how politics happens. I'm going to go live here. It would be nice if I had everything together, wouldn't it? Okay. But here we go. We're going live We're live up on Twitter. Make sure my volume is good. Thanks for joining me, everyone, on Twitter. And I want to touch on a few things today. I've written a book recently about about nationalism. Here, I may as well hold it up. The populist wave, the origin and rise of American nationalism and populism. I love writing. And I'm now writing a book about Judaism, which of course is a subject that is dear to my heart as a Jew, where I'm examining from a sociological standpoint, more than from a religious standpoint, what Judaism is and what influence it has had on its own adherents and on the world, on civilization. Also, at the same time, I'm examining the various contentions and arguments of its detractors and its enemies, both on the left and the right. So, you know, I'm enjoying that. I'm kind of immersed in it. But I think today I'd just like to talk a little bit about the broad question of conspiracy, that terrible word that was demonized in the aftermath of the assassination and murder of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy on November 22, 1963, an event that has greatly affected me ever since personally. I was a kid at the time, but I remember it very well. I remember it as if it happened yesterday. And it's an event that I think changed the course of American history, literally and philosophically, and how we see ourselves. In the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, and I write about this in my book, The Populist Wave, the United States changed in a way that we've never been the same. We immediately, within hours, really, within days, Lyndon Johnson escalated the Vietnam War. He canceled the silver certificates that had been authorized by Kennedy, whereas currency was being issued into the economy directly, backed by silver, which he discovered at Fort Knox, and which had done an end run around the Federal Reserve System, and thus issuing debt-free currency into our economy, something that many have speculated, particularly the late Jim Mars, whom I've interviewed in the past and who wrote many excellent books, was a contributing factor to his assassination. And other events as well. I mean, there are rumors that Kennedy wanted, he wanted to end this policy, which had been in place in this country ever since the World War I, when it was launched. And that is a condition of perpetual war for a perpetual peace. Kennedy wanted to de-escalate. He wanted to do what Donald Trump did and called for. He wanted to have a peace agreement with Cuba, a peace agreement with China. He wanted to stop the constant war that the United States had been embroiled in as sort of a gendarme of the world since World War I. That didn't mean that he wanted to surrender American sovereignty. Quite the contrary. He wanted to strengthen America's military might and ensure that we had the ability to defend our republic from on both fronts and successfully, and that we could continue to aid our allies as a last resort militarily if they were invaded. But he wanted to end this condition of perpetual embroilment and war, what President George Washington warned us about, foreign entanglements, maintain friendly relations with foreign powers and diplomatic relations and trade relations, but not military alliances that would embroil us in these senseless foreign wars. We should note that the American Republic and the American Declaration of Independence was an attempt to extricate ourselves from these European intrigues that were constant and that were bloody and that were built on dynastic rivalries and secret societies. We wanted to extricate ourselves from that and maintain our independence as a continental republic of sovereign states that would come together to form a union. That was the American ideal. And that was an ideal that John F. Kennedy embraced. And it was the opposite of what the deep state seeks. And that's what I want to talk about today. It was also the opposite. And let me just bring things up to the present. So Kennedy is assassinated. Johnson is a tool of this internationalist cabal. He does their bidding by escalating the Vietnam War under the phony pretext of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which 40 years later, it has been acknowledged was untrue and that was a fake. And he also expands the central government into areas that it had not been involved in previous, with programs like the War on Poverty, which we lost, the Great Society, which was not great, and a kind of a further militarization of the domestic scene. Nixon comes along and is also a player on the establishment, but he starts to demonstrate some independence. First of all, and this is according to Roger Stone, I haven't interviewed him in recent years, but I've read some of his books. I'm not saying I completely endorse everything that he's said, but he is an insider and he is a patriot and he is a whistleblower. And he's noted recently that he's studying the Kennedy assassination, and he was a very close confidant of Richard Nixon, that in 1972, Nixon won re-election with the largest electorate in history. No president then or since has been as popular as Nixon was. He got 17 million more votes than his opponent, George McGovern. No one's ever even come close to that. I mean, Barack Obama was a popular president, but I think that he might have had 4 or 5 million more than his opponent. So Nixon won an unprecedented landslide, and he carried 49 of 50 states. The only state that he lost was my own home state of Massachusetts. And that was even close. That was almost a fluke. And then a year and a half later, he's gone. He's out of office. He's replaced by an unelected vice president, because they removed Agnew also, who then becomes president, that being Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was not a bad guy, but, you know, he's kind of a place setter. I mean, he was an establishment figure. He had also been on the Warren Commission, and he was part of covering up the Kennedy assassination. And many of the papers associated with the Warren Commission are still classified to this day. And he's famously stated at the time that the commission was delivering their final report that the American people needed closure, he said. We didn't need closure. We needed the truth. We didn't get the truth. We still don't have the truth. Well, Nixon, according to Roger Stone, had a meeting with the CIA director, Richard Helms, where he said, "I want to get to the bottom of who killed John," John being John F. Kennedy. And Helms just sat there in stony silence. This goes to similar situations that were brought up to me by Michael J. Glennon, the author of National Security and Double Government. All right. Michael Glennon is a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. You can listen to my archives on the interview I did with him. I'm trying to get him back. He's an establishment figure. He was a Senate legal counsel during, I think, the Clinton administration. And he talks about the fact that, in brief, I don't want to get off the topic here, that Harry Truman signed the National Security Act, 1947, and that established legalized secret societies that eventually would form a double government in this country. That included the CIA, the NSA, the National Security Council, and other agencies. And that they he said that they respond that way in that they don't really answer to what he calls the Madisonian government, the official government, the president, the Congress, the Supreme Court. He calls them the Trumanites, the unelected bureaucrats and figures who are not accountable to the public and who actually are invisible, but who actually do the governing. Now, that's not me saying this. This is Michael J. Glennon from Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy writing this, okay? So he's not some right-wing nut. He's the real McCoy. So anyway, that was the reaction by Richard Helms, the head of the CIA, stony silence. And it was shortly after that that Nixon was taken out of office. And that we know that the main player in terms of getting rid of Nixon was this young and unknown naval intelligence officer who resigned from the Navy under questionable circumstances, no one knows, by the name of Bob Woodward. Woodward went to work for the Washington Post, and of course, with his partner Bernstein, broke the Watergate story and promoted it, and met with this guy that was called Deep Throat. The identity of Deep Throat wasn't revealed until 20 years later, and it turns out that he was Mark Felt. Mark Felt was a high-level FBI agent and was the head of the COINTELPRO program at the FBI. The FBI is part of this double government, certainly. And in that capacity, he was heading up an agency that was infiltrating and discrediting Americans, in some cases legitimately, I may note, but nevertheless, secretly, that were seen as holding interests that were contrary to the deep state. So apparently he wanted to take out Nixon. So Nixon is gone. Then Jimmy Carter is elected in 1976. And I cover this in my book about assassinations, by the way. You could check out all of my books. I'm self-sponsored here. You just go to Amazon and put my name in the server, Charles Moskowitz, and they'll come up. Anyway, Jimmy Carter wanted to release information about the Kennedy assassination. He talked about this publicly. So there Jimmy Carter is delivering a speech in Los Angeles in a public place outside near a hotel. And in the hotel, the FBI finds, raids, and arrests these two homeless bums who had weapons and who the newspapers claimed were attempting to assassinate Jimmy Carter. Now, these two bums, one of them's name was Lee Harvey, and the other one was named, I think, Miguel Oswaldo. All right. Now, they were held overnight and then they were let go. They were homeless. Yeah, they were just, I think one of them was an illegal alien. The other one was just a homeless guy. They were let go and never heard from again. But the newspapers reported this and it was a sensational story for about a day. And the point here being that if you juxtapose that strange story with the release a few days earlier by the Carter administration that they wanted to investigate and release files on the Kennedy assassination, you would have to conclude that that is an obvious message to Jimmy Carter. Guess what? Watch your P's and Q's, or Lee Harvey and Mr. Oswaldo were going to come out and do you know what. So after that, Jimmy Carter was not the same man. He really, you know, got the hint. Then, of course, comes Reagan. Reagan is shot in the open. I don't really know if there's a connection there other than that Reagan was talking about going back to the gold standard and possibly threatening the power of the money, power of the Federal Reserve. I don't know that, but that's a rumor. I do include that in my book with a lot of qualifications, saying that I could not absolutely source that. And then we come up to Donald Trump. Donald Trump wanted to do all of the things that the deep state opposed. He wanted to de-escalate America's involvement in perpetual war. In fact, Trump, there were no wars during his 4 years in office. He got North Korea to stop firing missiles. He was bringing North Korea to the peace table. or certainly getting them closer to it than they'd ever been. He basically obliterated ISIS and brought a peace agreement between the state of Israel and six Arab countries. That didn't happen by accident. That happened because Donald Trump was different than this kind of, what Michael Glennon calls double government. I mean, this sort of amorphous agenda. He came in there as an outsider. He wasn't beholden to anybody. He couldn't be blackmailed. They tried that and it didn't work. He didn't owe anybody anything because he self-financed his campaign. And he was a businessman. So they worked a conspiracy to try to stop Trump, not in the literal sense, like they did maybe with others. And we know I could mention whom I'm talking about here, but more by trying to smear him and discredit him. Hello, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. Hello, speak up. Yep, let me just make sure my sound is good. Yes, sir, you're on the air. Are you there? Well, if you want to speak up, you're welcome to. This is a call-in show, and I'm happy to welcome your calls. All right, we do have a caller, but for whatever reason, he's not speaking or I'm not hearing. Let me just see. Are you there? Come in. Let me hear you. Are we not getting a sound? Let me just see if I'm having an issue here. Maybe send me a chat and we can do it that way. Let's just see. Hello? No? All right. The call ended. Anyways, you're welcome to join me. Charles Moskowitz live Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 617-396-4958, 617-396-4958. And if I inadvertently messed up that call, I deeply apologize. Please try again. You know, I'm not the most adept person when it comes to technicals. But, you know, give me a break here. Let's try to get the show happening with calls. That would be fantastic. So please call 617-396-4958. If you'd like to chat, go to the Rumble page, rumble.com/Moskowitz, M-O-S-C-O-W-I-T-Z, and you can send me a live chat, and I will read that over the air. Of course, you can always email me at charlesmoskowitz@gmail.com. Anyway, getting back to the topic at hand. Trump was not cut of the mold of the establishment. Trump was talking about taking on the Federal Reserve. Trump was talking about he was forcing NATO to pay for its own financing and to finance its own military expenditures rather than the taxpayer. He was cutting back on a lot of these deep state programs. And he was going to do more as he got in. Now, he had his weaknesses. He was surrounded by some of these people that couldn't be trusted. We just saw that skunk Bill Barr on with Bill Maher, the comedian. I didn't see it. I don't know if I had the stomach for it, but I did read about it. He completely lied to Trump when he told him that he had investigated election fraud, when he didn't, and he turned out to be, and when he received notices from people who were concerned about it, including some government state legislators in Pennsylvania and Michigan, he completely ignored them. Told him to go to hell, basically. Likewise with Christopher Krebs, who was the head of the cybersecurity and who announced that this was the most clean election in history. That was bull. He didn't know anything about it at the time. And he was ignoring genuine concerns that were being brought up. So that was obviously a setup, okay? Anybody who has half a wit knows it. But getting back to my main topic here, the great what the John Birch Society used to call the great conspiracy, the grand conspiracy. There are discussions in terms of when this really happened. I was listening to an interview being conducted by Jack Posobiec, who I admire. He does a great show at Human Events. Former naval intelligence officer mentioned that he researched how China fell to the communists. And he's is fluent in Mandarin, spent several years at Shanghai. And he brought up something that I think was very interesting, in that he says that toward the end of World War II, the deep state, if you will, whatever you want to call it, they wanted to set up the UN, and they wanted it to succeed after having failed to establish a League of Nations at the end of World War I. Let's not forget the United States did not join, mainly because of Massachusetts Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who did not allow it. And thus, it had no power. They wanted a more powerful UN, one that had military capabilities at the end of World War II. And they recognized that the only way to do that would be to have all of the superpowers as part of it, which was not the case with the League of Nations, since the United States didn't join. And that meant getting the Soviet Union to join. Can you imagine they wanted the Soviet Union? Okay. So the Soviet Union, of course, wanted concessions in return. Not that anybody should want them in it at all, but putting that aside. And that the concessions that they demanded was that they wanted to, they wanted China to become communist. And that the establishment internationalists, the same people that are running Davos, and I'll get into that in a minute, they gave that concession to China. There was already a civil war in China between our nationalist allies headed by Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong. But at the end of World War II, Chiang Kai-shek was predominant and Mao Zedong was in hiding. But that reversed because of this agreement, and because the United States sent over George C. Marshall as basically the de facto dictator of China for several years under the Truman administration after World War II. He served the same role in China that Douglas MacArthur served in Japan, and that Dwight Eisenhower served in Germany, or his successor, I think it was General Lucius Clay. Except the problem is that, unlike MacArthur, who helped Japan become a free country and write a constitution, and who brought the emperor out to meet people and he humanized him, and you know he's responsible for modern Japan, which is an extremely successful free nation, Marshall deliberately stabbed Chiang Kai-shek in the back. And if you look at the U.S. State Department and the people that were influencing it at the time, people like Undersecretary of the UN, Undersecretary of State Alger Hiss, who was directly working with Stalin, and who was also, by the way, the founding Secretary General of the United Nations. I don't know if people realize that. And Harry Dexter White, Undersecretary of the Treasury, who is the author of the Morgenthau Plan, which wanted to pasteurize Germany, which would have been an absolute catastrophe, mainly because he wanted to, you know, open the doors to the Soviet Union and to Sovietize Europe, because he was I mean, I don't know if he was a card-carrying communist, but he certainly was working with them. As a result, in 1949, after the U.S. stabbed Chiang Kai-shek in the back, after we refused to deliver him military aid, We actually sank it in the Pacific rather than deliver it to him. After White, Harry Dexter White, arranged to cut off gold shipments, which would have stabilized their currency because they had great inflation after the war. Don't forget, it was China that bore the burden of most of the Pacific theater in World War II. After all this, communist China fell to the communists in 1949. And the result was, 30 million people murdered by the communist regime. And the problems we're having today, the fall of North Korea, which is another subject, the fall of North Vietnam, the amount of suffering and the amount of human potential destroyed and lives destroyed is something that is literally incalculable as a result of these things. Now, that's an interesting starting point for the deep state, or for this conspiracy, which I do call it a conspiracy. The more conventional approach, I think the one that was embraced by the John Birch Society, which I think is a patriotic group and a well-meaning group, by the way, is also true. I mean, they're all true in that they look at the year 1912, the year that Woodrow Wilson became president as a minority president in a three-way race between himself, the sitting president, Howard Taft, and Teddy Roosevelt, who ran as the Bull Moose third-party candidate. And that Wilson and his handlers, who were very pro-British and pro-City of London, they arranged for the Federal Reserve Act, which turned America's monetary system over to this cartel of private this private quasi-public bankers and investors who immediately started shipping gold to Europe. World War I broke out, I think, about 9 months after the Federal Reserve Act was signed. He had pro-British people around him, including his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, who actually used to speak with a British accent, and whose nephew was John Foster Dulles, who served under Eisenhower, and who was likewise an internationalist. And they pushed the United States into World War I because they wanted to embroil this country unnecessarily into these foreign wars. That was also the year, 1913, the first year of Wilson, that the income tax amendment was passed, which for the first time as a permanent structure would tax every American's income. The government would now have a little, glimpse at the private business of every American citizen who earned money. Part of that act, which is not as well known, set up nonprofits and foundations. So these enormous combines of wealth that had emerged in the early part of the 20th century, like the Rockefeller family and the Carnegies and the Mellons, they could then put their money in these huge foundations tax-free, and that these foundations, whether at the time or later, would basically employ these aristocratic, informal aristocrats who would further control the country and would also finance liberal left-wing causes and candidates around the country to further their power. There was a congressional investigation of this in the 1950s, the Reese Commission, where, there's a lot, I mean, it's too big a subject to get into right now, but there was a lot uncovered about how this works. And there were several other things that happened that year. My guest earlier this week, Dr. John Rechtenwald, talked about Davos and the Great Reset as being a repackaging of the New World Order, which he traces back to the Rhodes Roundtable Group, as covered by Dr. Carol Quigley, who Here, I have his book, Tragedy and Hope. This one is it's dull, but it's important. Cecil Rhodes, the racist British imperialist Governor General of South Africa, and the founder of the De Beers Diamond Mines, established these secret societies, these Rhodes Roundtables, which had as their goal, according to Professor Carol Quigley, who, by the way, was the head of the Foreign Affairs Department of Georgetown University, and he was a mentor to Bill Clinton and many others. I think he also mentored Zbigniew Brzezinski. That their goal was to establish a world order under an Anglo-American control. He wanted to merge the United States and the British Commonwealth into an informal empire. They spawned several secret societies that became really the rulers of the world and still are. In London, you had the Royal Institute of International Affairs, or Chatham House. In the United States, in New York, you had the Council on Foreign Relations. And they had other satellite organizations around the world. There's one in India, there's one in Australia. The CFR has spun off into different cities in the United States. And their agenda was to create a world order by using war, perpetual war for perpetual peace, which was a book written by historian Charles Austin Beard, who exposed this in the 1920s and who was then denounced because of it. They called him an anti-Semite and the usual charges. And that's, where possibly this conspiracy began, with Cecil Rhodes around the turn of the 19th to 20th century. I would argue that this conspiracy is more, it's something that has cropped up in every generation from the time of Adam and Eve. Whittaker Chambers, the author of Witness, who was an American communist in the 1930s, who went underground and who handled, in the Roosevelt administration, various communists or communist assets who were helping Stalin, and who then changed his mind and became a patriot, mainly because he came to believe in God, and because he was upset, the final straw for him and his final break with the Communist Party was when he saw that Stalin and Hitler were allied and that they had formed a pact. And he felt like, this is too much, this is too dangerous for the world. I have to alert someone in the FDR administration about this infiltration by communists, because now these same communists are working for the Nazis. And they did. People don't realize this, but between August 9th, 1939, and June 22nd, 1941, which was the launch of Operation Barbarossa, where Hitler double-crossed Stalin, his ally, and invaded Russia, Russia and Germany, Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia, were allies, were collaborating with each other, were working together. And thus you had these communist spies at high levels of the Roosevelt administration who were working for Adolf Hitler. That was too much for Chambers. So he met with a Roosevelt high-level official by the name of Adolf Burley. It had been a meeting that had been set up by Rabbi Singer from Cleveland, who knew people in the Roosevelt administration. And he warned them. And then he turned state's evidence. And of course, after the war, that led to the trial, the Hiss trial, when he named Alger Hiss in public. And Hiss actually ended up going to jail and he was convicted. The point I'm making is that Chambers, in his introduction to his book, Witness, puts together this brilliant, brilliant chapter, his letter to his children, where he says, and it's very philosophical, of course, and religious, that the conspiracy is the second oldest religion known to man. That the conspiracy occurred in the Garden of Eden. The oldest religion, of course, is belief in the Lord God, King of the universe, blessed be he, the creator of the universe, the giver of the law. That's the oldest religion, and that's the true religion. The second oldest religion, as Chambers notes, and I'm paraphrasing here, was when Eve and Adam partook of the forbidden fruit at the tree of knowledge, having been goaded to do so by the serpent, who represents Satan, the fallen angel, and because they wanted to know all things. They wanted to know good and evil. They wanted to be as God, basically. They wanted to overthrow God in heaven. They were tempted to do it by the serpent who lured them into it. These are our ancient parents, Adam and Eve. And once they did partake, then they were, of course, they had disrupted the order that God had created, and God diminished them. He banned them from Eden forever. And they lost their spiritual condition. And, they were basically made to work and suffer and deal with all of the vicissitudes of life that we all deal with today. And that their sin was that they tried to be as God. They tried to overthrow God in heaven and destroy the natural order of the universe, where we are not God. We're created in the image of God, which means that we're not perfect and we will never be made perfect. But yet there is this conspiracy in every generation from that time until today, where you have some people who think that they could be as God, just like Adam and Eve thought they could, and they learned the hard way that they could not. And it's these same people, I think, inspired, frankly, by the same serpent, who is Satan, who caused the big wars, who caused the big depressions, who caused the big terrorism, and who launched the big holocausts and genocides. Now, you always are going to have little wars. I mean, we all, that's human nature, unfortunately. Sometimes conflicts become so bad that ultimately things do break down and you have war. You have murder, you have sin. These are part of our imperfect nature. We're all tempted by these things. We all are battered by these different forces throughout our imperfect lives. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the big wars, the international wars. That's where you end up with something bigger than just your average human nature. That's where this conspiracy comes in. And every generation has had to deal with it. Steve Bannon, Jack Posobiec pointed out in his great presentation, by the way, on Human Events, where he interviews Noor Ben Laden, she's a reporter. He noted that at the founding of the American Republic, the founding fathers, the founding generation, they fought against and rejected the world order conspiracy of their day, which was the King of England. They wanted the King of England was a tyrant who had aspirations to conquer the world. That's what a lot of those wars were about. That's what the French and Indian War was about. That's what the 30 Years' War was about in Europe. I suppose we could go back to to Babylon. I mean, every generation has had this idea that you have people who feel that they know better and that they can triumph over their fellow man and create a godlike utopia on earth. And they can't, because they're humans. And that the people that fight against them were the patriots who founded this republic, and who are today the populists and the nationalists. And they're breaking out all over the world. And we are opposing this amoral conspiracy, and I do use the word conspiracy, to basically replace God with themselves, because they think they have some enlightened knowledge to that we don't possess. And they feel entitled to do this. They think they're moral when they try to do it. Adolf Hitler believed he was moral when he tried to cleanse the all of humanity from races that he felt were inferior, or in the case of the Jews, races that he felt threatened his idea of a moral people. This is what Soviet Russian communism is all about. This is what communism itself is all about, going back to its founding during the time of the Illuminati. And yeah, it was the Illuminati, in my opinion, overthrowing the faith, overthrowing sovereignty, overthrowing institutions that are natural to us, like the family, like individual consciousness, like the fact that, you know, the right to possess property and to trade and to maintain sovereignty over your own life under God and your own destiny and that of your family, to replace that with this illuminated elite that knows better. I mean, in the case of communism, I mean, these visions differ. In the case of communism, it's this idea of a one world ant colony where everyone is de facto equal. That's the virtuous idea of humanity. In the more fascist case, it's this, which I think has been really started by Cecil Rhodes, and I think it's very much what the Great Reset's about now. It's this informal merger between elected governments, which sort of serve as the Madisonians of the world, as Glennon would call them, and these informal, unelected combines of wealth and power, who actually run the scene and who work in partnership, and who leave in place the window dressing of sovereignty and the window dressing of religions, when they actually are gutting it out and replacing it with their amoral collectivist vision that they have for the rest of us. Now, the latest version coming out of Davos is that we're going to all eat bug sandwiches and not own anything. And they're very open about that. And that they have to further whittle away their opponents, which is the sovereignty of the United States, which is under serious threat today. I don't know if people realize, but this Biden has signed this agreement with Canada and Mexico, which really sets back our ability as a republic and as a sovereign people to conduct our own affairs and to control our own futures. And they're really moving forward with it today in a way that I think is more dangerous and more deadly than anything in the past, including Holocausts, world wars, you name it. Because today, they have access to technologies that are nothing like the predecessors had, even with a nuclear bomb. Today, they control, they're trying to digitize and categorize the entire world in a gigantic, massive electronic brain that they control. Artificial intelligence. Now you have technology that can replace people with machines. Transhumanism. You have this vision that's put forth by Ray Kurzweil here at MIT and Harari over in Israel, where the human being has evolved. And Darwin was a major figure in this movement. That's why he's such a saint. That human beings, we can change human nature by force. In his case, it was through breeding to create a superior species. Except now the superior species that they want to create, unlike the Nazi Übermensch, which was blonde hair, blue eyes, super strength, super beauty, live to be 200, have cosmic consciousness, this new race that would pop out of the old race called the Aryans, which is, by the way, an occult idea that was originated by Theosophy and Martina Blavatsky. And that's the official religion, by the way, of the UN. Except now, instead of being a super race like that, they want to combine human biological beings as created in the image of God with machines. They want to implant computers. They want to regulate the body electronically. And they want to do it through some of these technologies, I fear, not just what Elon Musk is talking about with brain chips, but I don't know, and I'm going to say this, and I'm not saying it's true because I don't know, but I think that this is what the mRNA experiment is all about, what CRISPR is all about. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I've heard a little bit, and I've heard enough of it from people who are, to say that these technologies are going to alter our DNA. They're going to alter our genes, and they're going to ultimately cause these evil, you know, conspirators to control who we are, to alter who we are. It's going to be an end of freedom. Anyway, on that happy note, I'm kind of reaching toward the end of the program. I've got an interesting guest tomorrow. We're going to be talking about the state of Israel. And then Wednesday, I have Christina Bob, who is President Trump's personal attorney. Thursday, I think I'm getting David Horowitz from the Horowitz Institute. So I've got an interesting lineup of people. Check out the show. My archive is up at Rumble. Please subscribe there. I want to thank the good people at TECN-TV, the Exceptional Conservative Network, Ken McClanton for carrying the show. I urge my listeners to go to their website, TECN/TV, and check out their excellent lineup of guests. And I just want to say that I don't mean to be a gloomy Gus here. I generally am optimistic. I know that might sound a little weird after everything I just talked about, but I am. Mainly because I believe in God and because I believe that God has agency on earth through people who believe in God. And, you know, we can, in that capacity, in our imperfect way, change human nature. And we have. Every generation has had people who were conscious and who stood up and who said no to this establishment. That was what the American Revolution was all about. We stood up and said no to it. We became aware of it and we rejected it. And I think that there is a growing movement today that is rejecting this order. Donald Trump is certainly a leader of it. They did not expect that to happen. There are other movements that also fill me with hope. The Brexit movement in England, the assertion of sovereignty by Eastern European countries, dissidents in China who are fighting this horrible, evil, communist, you know, behemoth. These people have great courage. You know, I mean, they're not sitting back. African nations are emerging. The truckers in Canada, thank God for the truckers. They stopped the electronic passports, which would have been an end to freedom. And, you know, we're paying attention to what's going on in Davos. There were books being published. I'm going to be having people on who are going to be further exposing that agenda. And I think that if we all pitch in and do our part, we can counter this movement. We can say no to it. We can expose it. And when you expose it to the light of day, it collapses on its own lies and its own deceptions. I believe that. I've seen it. I've seen it happen in my own life. I've seen it happen with myself as I've debugged myself over these years. Anyone who's involved in this nationalist and patriotic movement knows, I think, what I'm talking about here. Anyhow, on that note, I want to thank you all for joining me this afternoon. If you want to support the program, which is Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I am self-sponsored. My books are available at Amazon Books, The Populist Wave, The Origin and Rise of American Nationalism and Populism is my latest, and it's available at Amazon Books as a hardcover, softcover, and ebook. I've got about 15 other books up there covering a big, broad cross-section of issues. It's a piece of my mind. That's how I sponsor myself. I offer a piece of my mind. They're not expensive. And please subscribe to me at Rumble. My Twitter account is starting to move up a bit, which I'm pleased about. And I applaud Elon Musk, even though I don't agree with him on the brain chips for sure. Nevertheless, I'm proud of him for having decensored Twitter, and I'm hoping that leads to a decensorship of all of these rotten big tech companies that are censoring and stepping on free speech. Anyways, again, I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon. God bless you all. God bless America. And let's keep the faith. Thank you.